Good morning. Greetings in Jesus' name. The subject for this morning was already introduced and in some ways seems to clash with the deep richness of the John study we were just doing, but no, it doesn't. It doesn't really. It's just as rich, and I want you to turn to Genesis 2 to begin with. We're talking about applying wisdom to the marriage relationship, but here in Genesis 2, follow along here, let's read at 2:18. And the Lord God said, "It is not good that man should be alone. I will make and help meet for him." And out of the ground the Lord formed every beast of the field and every fowl of the air and brought them unto Adam to see what he would call them. And whatsoever Adam called every living creature, that was the name thereof. Adam gave names to all cattle and to the fowl of the air and to every beast of the field. But for Adam there was not found an help meet for him. And the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon Adam, and he slept. And he took one of his ribs, closed up the flesh instead thereof, and the rib which the Lord God had taken from man made he a woman, and brought her unto the man. And Adam said, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, because she was taken out of man. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh." Now that is an amazing passage of Scripture with a lot of mystery about it, I suppose. But the first reason God gives for the institution of marriage is a simple one. Adam's lonely. That's a very simple thing. It says the animals weren't lonely. It doesn't say that, but it implies that. But Adam was. We need to get a friend for Adam. And so companionship is God's first stated reason for marriage, the institution of marriage. This is repeated in the New Testament. But so I would say that although some can and do flourish alone for periods of their life, maybe a whole life, God planned that most adults go through life in pairs, in special pairs. It's a unique relationship for emotional stability, for an atmosphere of protected procreation. It's a place for the nurture of offspring that God put us in pairs. And it is not demeaning to the beauty of marriage in the human family to see that it looks something very much like that in the geese. That's not demeaning to the beauty of it in the human scale, on the human level, because it's equally miraculous in the geese. It's equally God's doing. And so it doesn't pull down the beauty of this. Quoting from Paul, "For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and shall be joined unto his wife, and they two shall be one flesh." This is a great mystery. This is a great mystery, he said. So, if you're married for more than 3 years, here, do you consider your union a little mysterious? Raise your hand if you do. Okay. By mysterious, it means there are aspects of it you do not quite comprehend nor understand, and words fail you to explain both its delights and sometimes its troubles. That is the nature of a mystery. And if you've been married for less than that or a few weeks or something, that's fine. The mystery will come all in good time. If you don't think it is a mystery yet, I should give this disclaimer. It is not intentional that I'm here in Maryland speaking about marriage in the absence of a certain Mrs. M, who would normally be sitting on the pew here for my accountability for what I say. But it is true that we had a clash of schedules, and she could not come along on this trip, which is a great disappointment to me. But we have had 27 or more, over 27 years of domestic tranquility and marital bliss, and so even through some stormy years and so on. And I say that to say that what I have to share this morning about marriage is not just something I read in books. And I think that those of you who've been married for some years know that the wisdom which comes from above and comes into your marriage has no shortcuts. None at all. It takes years for that wisdom to come. And so, if you haven't been married for years, that doesn't mean that you're somehow vulnerable to... actually it does mean that. You're vulnerable to making some blunders if you haven't been married for many years. And you are when you've been married for many years too. But let's go into what the Scriptures has to teach here. We were talking last night about other human relationships. Now I'm just going to show this, our chart again. Because there are comparisons here that are the same and some that are different. Marriage is a human relationship like others, but it is unlike brotherhood relationships or filial or love between parents and children, which we'll talk about tonight. There is some similarity. So just going quickly over this from last night. How does the beginning marriage relationship progress through these stages? Well, it does. However, this stage typically is gotten through faster than maybe another one, because there is the difference of the spark that God puts in men and women to be drawn to each other. And so they get through this a little faster, although a woman is going to need more reassurance that she's safe with an unknown man than vice versa. This is the way God made us. The woman has more to lose in some sense, and she's going to need to be reassured that it's safe to be with this man before she will commit. But we will go through this step. Stage two is not quite as transparent nor as honest as other relationships, because the fire of love that is driving a man and a woman together makes the discovery sometimes not quite as genuine as it could be, because if I find myself attracted to this mate, I'm going to, in my conversations with her or him, I'm going to want certain things to be true whether they're true or not. Right, I want to believe that she's amazing. I want to believe that he is. I don't know. He's probably managing that whole business himself, or whatever it is that makes you think that this potential mate is really amazing. You want the little red flags to not be true in courtship. We're predisposed to just kind of gloss over some things that you saw, and maybe you didn't even see them. So the discovery is a little different. We don't do mail order brides anymore, like we're done in some eras of history. And so we do visit a little bit to find out if we have some things in common to see if we can progress. But it moves on pretty quickly. I think about that. It is true, though. I mean, if you court this person to be your spouse for life, and you come across nothing at all that you both enjoy, that it seems like this would make for some awkward silences in the process of getting to know this man or this woman. If there was nothing at all, I remember the first time that I held a conversation with the woman that was going to be my wife for life. We sat down across the table from each other at Bible school, and I thought I knew who she was. I sort of knew, but I wasn't positive it was the right person. And so somewhere in the meal, I don't know how long it took me to get up the courage, but I said to her, "Are you the person that whose name I have seen published in some poetry circular or something?" And because I liked to read and I liked poetry, and I wondered if she was that person whose name I had seen before. And she said, "Yes, she is." And soon after that, we decided to get married. There was a little time in there, but what I'm saying is that it was the first thing that drew us together, is that something we both liked and we could connect on that. And you know, it's been many years. That's been almost 30 years ago, and we still quote Dickinson and Eliot to each other because we enjoy that. So how do we get to stage three then? Well, sharing, gift giving happens pretty quickly in the courtship when we're trying to build this relationship. The man or the woman wants to show tokens of the growing affection, and it comes from this process. And I know, I don't know how it was in your courtship. I'm a little puzzled today, frankly, I'll say it that way, at the custom of on the first date. The man arrives with a $80 armload of gift shop roses, floral shop roses, to present to this person that he wants to get to know. And the reason I'm puzzled by that is because it messes up my model. Because it's not because it's affection. It can't be. He doesn't know this woman. So what is it? A peace offering? Bait? Or some kind of, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's just courteousness. Women like flowers, so show up with flowers. Can't go wrong with that. I don't know what it is. All I'm saying is that the gift giving of the first time you meet is not at all like after you get to know this person. That's something else. It's something artificial. It's fine if that's what you did in your courtship. That's great. It seems to me that, as I have observed it in our custom today, it's less about the flowers than about getting a picture with you and the flowers and them, so you can send it around to all your friends. So maybe it's just a photographic backdrop. I'm not sure, but let's move on here. We get to stage four then, somewhere when a couple builds this relationship and they go to the marriage altar and they say that they I will, I do, and now they're covenanted together. And they think that they would die for each other, and they don't know what they're talking about. Oh, they would, maybe. Some have. Some have in the early weeks of their marriage. One has died for the other. This has happened. But they don't understand the dying till later, and we'll get to that. So it is a relationship. Christ did die for us while we were yet sinners. Someone made the comment, I think it was Brother David, that Jesus works backwards on this list. And that's there's some interesting tie-ins to that, because all through this consideration about Christian marriage, we have to remember the model in Scriptures is always what? Christ and the church. And there are such close and beautiful ties to that. So, well, my second point is that, I'll say this. You know, this sounds like we have two free moral agents who are operating out here in this social sphere, and somehow they see one that they think is going to be their mate for life, and they approach each other with little overtures and little, you know, and after a while they figure it out, and after a while they become a couple. But this avoids the fact that maybe the majority of the world's marriages and millions of happy ones don't come together that way at all. They come together because mom and dad found you a wife or a husband. And here she is, son. Covenant with her, and God bless you. There is no discovery and choosing and deciding whether this is the one that the sparks fly for me. You know, there's no personal choice. And I don't have meaning to go into that, because that's not where we live. That's not what we do. All I'm saying is that if you are a young person and you think, "Ooh, what if mom and dad picked my spouse? I mean, really? Would I trust my parents to do that?" Well, if you would be living in that culture, you probably would, because you wouldn't know anything else. But don't as little, you know, don't as Westerners, as Americans, look down on that too badly, because it works pretty well. Not always, but probably better than the Western marriages where we go shopping ourselves. I don't know. I don't want to reflect on that because my parents did not choose my wife for me. But I'm assuming that if I had turned it over to them, they would have found the same one. But we'll move on. Christian marriage is more than a relationship. So now we're going to leave this behind a little bit. Christian marriage is more than a relationship. It is a covenant. It is a covenant. We just read, they're going to leave father and mother and cleave to each other. Jesus repeated it. There are not two people now, they're one flesh. And so let not man divide it. So two parties enter into a pact and a commitment to stay loyal in spite of the circumstances. And that's actually why the parent-chosen marriages work. Because it starts somewhere down here at the covenant end. And then because of the tremendous force of community custom and religious expectation, that man and woman learn to love each other. And they do become close in time. But it wasn't the other way around. So, set me as a seal upon thine heart, Song of Solomon. As a seal upon thine arm, for love is strong as death. Song of Solomon 8:6. If you're serious about your marriage, you should underline that. You should say it to each other. Maybe send your wife a text in the middle of the day with that verse sometime. Wouldn't hurt. I mean, don't let me. I'm going to start over again. That would be a good thing. I thought that I had memorized the vow that I vowed on my wedding day, but I looked around my house and I couldn't actually find the exact text until I had to do a little digging. But we go to these weddings and we hear this. You think about the tone of covenantal relationship you hear in this. Men, will you, in the presence of God and these witnesses, take whoever it is, your wife's name, will you love and cherish her, provide and care for her in health and sickness? In prosperity, in adversity, exercise patience, kindness, forbearance toward her. Live with her in peace as becomes a faithful Christian husband. Forsaking all others, keep yourself only unto her as long as you both live. Both shall live. It doesn't say in there something like, will you be impressed and excited and passionate about this person as long as it is that way? No, it says, will you do this? Sisters, will you, in the presence of God and these witnesses, take your husband? Will you love and cherish him in health and sickness, in prosperity, in adversity? Share with him joys and sorrows of life. Which it doesn't say that to the men. I'm not sure why. Exercise patience, kindness, and forbearance toward him. It does say that to both. And live with him in peace. It does say that to both. As becomes a faithful Christian wife, forsaking all others, keep yourself only unto him as long as you both shall live. And when you're standing there in front of the bishop or whoever marries you, And it's almost like you're listening to that. We'll do that. And then there comes that little thing at the end there that almost is jarring. And forsaking all others. What others? Now, the wisdom of the gospel and the wisdom of the Bible and previous generations put that at the end of the vows. Forsaking all others. And only as you're married a while do you understand what forsaking all others means and why we say that. But you don't understand it at the wedding altar. Contrast the familiar Western trope, the American trope, the pop culture concept of falling in love. When you fall in love, you are a sort of victim, irresistibly drawn to this other. And you can't help it. You're swept off the feet. And a million country songs and pop songs celebrate this idea that I looked into your eyes the first time and I was just jelly. And oh, from there on, to match made in heaven. It had to be this way. It was so on and so on. And maybe you did feel that way. But you know, a covenant is a decision of the heart and mind. And I know that somehow that there's a beauty that we like to cling to, that it really sort of was that way when you first met your spouse-to-be. But passion, that excitement, that passion is always the fruit of commitment and not its binding glue. Passion comes and is sustained through life when the commitment underlies it and binds it together. And so, no, there is no romance great enough to keep you committed for life. None. Not in any of your marriages. That only exists in the novels and the movies and the Hallmark cards and the Valentine's Day Pinterest memes. It's just not true. That's not how it works. Marriage is strong and passionate when the strength of the covenant is underneath it every day. In prosperity and adversity. Please turn to Ephesians 5. Paul didn't have a wife, as far as we know, and yet he seemed to speak and write quite a bit about it by God's authority. Let's read Ephesians 5. Verse 22. Oh, 21 work. Submitting yourselves one to another in the fear of God. Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, as the church is subject unto Christ, let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives. Even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. So ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loveth himself. For no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, even as the Lord the church. For we are the are members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall be joined unto his wife, and they too shall be one flesh. This is a great mystery. But I speak concerning Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let every one of you in particular so love his wife even as himself, and the wife see that she reverence her husband. Now, there's a very foundational teaching here. I think we follow that. It's been written about in many books. But my point here is that love and respect are the foundations of a beautiful marriage. And I remember thinking about this years ago already, and then here in the last year or two, somebody gave me the famous husband and wife team that wrote the Love and Respect books. How many of you are familiar with those books, Love and Respect? So I think the teaching in there is reasonably sound, and it accords with what Paul is teaching and what I've thought for years. It's been my discovery as well, my experience. But this is not random advice from an unmarried man who's kind of imagining what your problems would be like as a couple. This is the man and the woman are both being asked to do a hard thing here. But we are in an environment that only points at the one. Our environment in America today and the strength of all of its mixed up views on feminism and gender roles only points out the one problem, and that is that it is somehow beastly, and somehow it is overbearing of the men to stand up front and preach about the need for the women to submit. That's not comfortable, and we have all kinds of ways to shy away from that and reinvent it. But the teaching of Paul isn't that at all here. Paul is simply saying, look, there is something in the essential nature of men and women that is different. They are not the same. And he says, sisters, I'm going to tell you about the thing that you're going to find the hardest. And it's to submit to that man you married and respect him no matter what. And he says, brothers, the hardest thing you're going to find in your marriage is to love and cherish the woman you married, always. So let's unpack this a little bit. I'm going to use some generalities here. So I don't want to be stoned for this. I want to simply say that this is indeed the way I've experienced life. And I think it accords with what we find. But a woman in general, the nature of a woman is that she finds her greatest fulfillment in being desired for what she is. Desired by men or her husband especially. Desired for what she is. She wants to be cherished. And so men, God says to you, you're going to have to be reminded of this because you're going to forget it. You're going to forget to do it. You're going to forget to pay attention to her desire for connection and companionship. And because she is vulnerable, that is her desire. The most hurtful thing you can do is to compare her personally to another woman unfavorably. That's the most hurtful thing you can do. It's more hurtful than to compare how she does her housekeeping to another woman. If you compare her person, what she is, how she looks, who she is as a person against another woman, that's the most hurtful thing you can do. So he says you must love and cherish her at all times. And to the sisters, he says, it's founded maybe in this idea that a man isn't that way. A man receives his greatest fulfillment in being admired or recognized for what he can do. Not what he is, but what he can do. And so he says, wives, you need to look at what your husband does, what he can get done, what decisions he makes, what his skills are, and you'll have to respect him for that. Because the Lord knows it's not always respectable. And men, you have to cherish your wife in the moments when she is not lovable. Because there are those, too, in every family. And so, wives, because a man gets his respect and gets his fulfillment in life out of being respected for what he can do, the most hurtful thing you can do to your husband is to cut him down or make fun of what he's getting done. Or compare it to other men. Compare your husband to what other men get done. That will be a dagger in his heart. And you know, this can be a vicious cycle. The wife could say, well, I would respect him if he would take some time for me once. Cherish me, show that he loves me. I would respect him. If we could sit down and talk. Why don't we just have time to talk? And the husband always says the same thing. About what? I'm not going to ask for a raise of hands. But I'm almost positive that there are marriages sitting right here this morning that have had that same conversation where the wife said, can we just talk? And the husband's like, what do you want to talk about? And that conversation, yes, I've had it with my wife. That conversation to me illustrates that the apostle knew what he was talking about. That illustrates the fundamental nature of it's not the other way around. The men don't go and say, honey, we just never talk. Can we just sit down tonight and talk for a while? And the wife says, well, we can, but about what? This is a reverse universe. It doesn't work that way. The apostle knew what he was saying. And it can be a virtuous cycle. Wives, When you admire your flawed husband, you admire what he gets done, his accomplishments. Yeah, he'll probably hold your hand and take a walk with you. If husbands, if you compliment your wife, maybe it's a surprise, but compliment how good she looks in that new dress or something, you'll stand taller in her eyes too. It can be a virtuous cycle. And so we could say, so he says, husbands, love your wives. And then where's the verse in the Bible? By the way, so where's the verse in the Bible that says, wives, love your husbands? It's not there. It's not anywhere in the Bible. There is a verse, yes, I know, where it says that the older sisters are supposed to teach the younger women to love their husbands, but the Greek word there is not love, is not agapeo like these others, where you love self-sacrificially. It's a lighter word that is, I think I had it, philandros, which is like an affectionate love. It's not the same thing. And so you mean the scriptures lets you off the hook completely, ladies? Well, no. But we're taught on the points that our relationship is most challenged on. And we've been too much influenced, I think, too sensitive about the gender role arguments. We're shy about teaching on submission for obvious reasons, because it feels a little awkward to be a man saying, now here's what the Bible says about submission. But it should be equally touchy to ask the men to talk to the men about cherishing their wives. Because it's just as hard. It's just as hard. Number three, the Holy Spirit can turn a marriage into a miracle of grace. Maybe you think yours already is or was on your wedding day. Maybe it was in some sense. But it's not really a miracle of grace until your marriage has gone for some years beautifully. Then it's a miracle of grace. You know, every spouse has a God-sized hole in their soul that only God can fill, and not the spouse. And one of the, if you try to fill your hole in your soul with your marriage relationship, you're only going to wreck your marriage. Because there's no answer. And I know, I can hear some people saying, yes, but what about the millions of American marriages that aren't particularly religious and they are doing just fine? No, they're not. They're not doing fine. There is no such thing as a miracle of grace in a marriage where two people are not submitted to the cleansing of the Lordship of Christ. Is this not possible? And so God has to do something in your life. I remember interviewing a brother who said that, and he said that, well, yes, they have a good marriage and everything. And we got talking about his Bible reading or his devotional life, his connection with God. Well, yeah, they doesn't really get much of that done. Seems kind of hard to read, and it's hard to find time to pray. And I just thought, that's a deceived husband. He doesn't have a good marriage. He can't. Because there's emptiness in his life, and when there's emptiness in your life, brothers, you cannot be a good husband. There's spiritual emptiness there. So don't think for a minute that you men can rush off to work all week long without time for Bible reading and prayer, and then believe that you're a good husband, because you're not. You can't be. You're going to be a selfish brute more often than you think. That's how it is. The reverse is true for the sisters. If the wives don't have time to connect with God, they're going to be deceived if they think they're a good wife, because they're not. So it has to start. The grace starts when Jesus Christ washes our souls and floods us with that grace, and then the connection can become beautiful between husband and wife. And I want you're here in Ephesians. Look, this is not accidental. I thought for years, I think, that Paul was just sort of getting to be an old man and his illustrations were wandering a little bit. You know, he's talking about the husbands and wives in verse 22, 23, and 24, 25, And then he goes off talking about Christ and the church again for several verses, and it seems like he forgot the whole husband and wife bit, that he might sanctify and cleanse it, the church, with the washing of water, and present it to himself a glorious church. And he's like, hey, Paul, we were talking about husbands and wives here. No, it's not accidental. There is something beautiful that Paul is drawing out here. He is saying that as Jesus gave himself for us, the church, to do what? When we were yet unlovely, he gave himself for us, and he has a mission. He's going to make us unwrinkled, unblemished, and beautiful. And he uses words like, it's going to be at the end of this process that it's going to be a glorious church. Now, there is the parallel here in that when a husband and wife come together in marriage, if Jesus is allowed to do for your marriage what he wants to do, he can use the man, and to some extent the woman, but primarily the man, to, how should we say this? That over a course of time, what is at first sort of you know, a little bit diamond in the rough about the relationship, becomes beautiful over years of glorifying. Your marriage can become glorified over years with commitment and submission. And it's a marvel of grace. And what Paul is saying is that just like Christ makes the church beautiful, Tim Keller, in his book on the meaning of marriage, he imagines two places where we stand before God. First is at the marriage altar, and he says, I will, this is beautiful, we are a model of Christ in the church. But he says the full glory doesn't come until the husband and wife stand before the throne of God at the end of life, and God says, now you're beautiful, now it's glorious, you've gone through a lifetime of submission and love, and now it's a glorious thing. So God can turn your marriage into a miracle of grace in time. Selfishness, on the other hand, you know, causes spiritual illness. We were talking about. Peter talks about this. I'll read this verse. Likewise, husbands, dwell with your wife according to knowledge, giving honor unto her as unto the weaker vessel, as being heirs together of the grace of life, so that you can pray. That your prayers be not hindered. So that means that the weight of this is on the husbands? I think so. The husband is the spiritual leader, and if he doesn't take his place, if he doesn't dwell with his wife according to knowledge and gives her the honor, there is going to be spiritual attrition in the marriage, and then the prayers don't go up anymore like the children's songs. The prayers go up, up, up. They don't when there is spiritual loss and selfishness in the marriage. Well, the fourth point here is that change is a sure thing in the marriage relationship, a challenging thing. You know, marriage changes us greatly, but not automatically for the better. I like Stanley Hauerwas's quote. He says, we almost always marry the wrong person. We never know whom we marry. We just think we do. Or even if we marry the right person, just give it a while and he or she will change. For marriage, being the enormous thing it is, means that we are not the same person after we have entered into it. The primary problem is learning how to love and care for the stranger to whom you find yourself married. Lewis Smead says this, when I married my wife, I had hardly a smidgen of sense for what I was getting into. How could I know how much she would change over 25 years? How could I know how much I would change? My wife has lived with at least 5 different men since we were wed, and each of the 5 has been me. Now, if you've married for a while, do you resonate with this a little bit? Marriage changes us tremendously, and some of us maybe have, I don't know, my background is a rather stoic, old order Mennonite background, and I learned early in life to stuff it, you know, just stiff upper lip, don't show other people the weakness of your emotions, and so on, and then I went and married a woman from a southern family who wasn't even Mennonite to boot, and who was much more living in the moment of the expression, you know, blow up and kiss up, you know, you just, it's clouds and sunshine and quick succession, and this is how the family relates there, And so we had a serious gap to close when we began our relationship. That's a big difference. And after 27 years, though, she has really learned to control her emotions. But I have learned to give hugs and to cry a little bit in public. It doesn't, you know, if it's really bad. But I remember first reading the book Far Into Familiar. Maybe some of you read that book. Tremendous book about hot and cold climate cultures, where you have different cultures in the world, and some are more canned in their expressions, and others are more bubbly and over the top, and how that makes a difference. And I remember when I first read it, just thinking how I know all about this because we were bringing two very different cultures together. But we changed. We changed, and that's the beauty of it. God allows circumstances to change our marriage relationship. Isn't that so true? Deaths, disappointments in life plans. I don't know. I reflect back. We wandered through many years of childlessness and health issues and years of trying to teach pay the bills on teaching salaries and so on, and believe that somehow this was all for the cause, and wandering. And just a lot of disappointments. And yet I look at myself today sometimes and I wonder why I can still be a selfish brute. How unbearable would I have been without all those reverses? What does God have left to sand off of my edges yet? But that is part of the refining of your marriage relationship, and you have to accept it, because if you fight it, it's not gonna bring the beauty. Well, sometimes we think we can't change, but we actually do all the time. You know, I've heard this kind of thing. Well, she wants me to be something that I'm not, the husband says. She wants me to be like the other big man, and I'm not that. And or the other wife says, well, you know, he expects me to be like his mom, some kind of Proverbs 31 woman who just gets it all done. Or you know, the wife might say that you know, or the husband might say that, you know, she's always comparing me against her wonderful dad, and I don't measure up somehow. I can't change who I am. But you can. Turn to Song of Solomon 2. There's a verse. My next point here is that little foxes spoil the vine. That's in Song of Solomon here, and it's an interesting one in talking about marriage relationships here. Song of Solomon 2, there's this beautiful nature scene where they're talking about how it's springtime. For lo, verse 11, the winter is past. The rain is over and gone. The flowers appear on the earth. The time of the singing of birds is come, and the voice of the turtle is heard in our land. The fig tree putteth forth her green figs. The vines with the tender grape give a good smell. Arise, my love, my fair one, come away. O my dove, thou art in the clefts of the rock and in the secret places of the stairs. Let me see thy countenance. Let me hear thy voice. For sweet is thy voice, and thy countenance is comely. So this is really framing us up here for this is a really tender time here. And then, take us the foxes, which really should be translated there something like, watch out for the foxes. Catch the foxes, the little foxes that spoil the vines, for our vines have tender grapes. That is the picture, that the marriage relationship is vulnerable to little nibblings. When it's at a, the beautiful parts of it are vulnerable to little nibblings that can destroy the beauty of it. And you can say, oh, yeah, but how does that happen? How does a stage four marriage relationship, when we're down here somewhere, how does this begin to unravel? Well, in reverse. Look at my points. First of all, we're unwilling to suffer for our husband or wife, for the spouse. We're unwilling to take the irritations. I've had enough. I've had enough of this. We can't abide their quirks anymore. So we're no longer ready to suffer for them. Maybe dying is a little off the table here. And then, if we do that for long enough, we'll start withholding the gifts of affection. We won't share anymore. oh, we might still give birthday gifts, but well, maybe we'll give the gifts of our affection somewhere else. Why will you be ravished with a strange woman? It's all through Proverbs. Why will you give your attention? She'll take you with your eyes, with her eyes. And so we begin to withhold some of the gifts of affection. And that unravels quickly then. Because we talked about that. When a woman feels that she's no longer cherished or special in her husband's eyes, but maybe somebody else's, then the things are really falling apart. And so what do we do then? We come here and we're no longer willing to be vulnerable or reveal ourselves to each other. And then we start having secret lives. And you don't see what's on my phone, and I don't see what's on your phone, and mind your business, what's it to you who I was talking to, or whatever. We start drawing apart and hiding what we're doing. Where were you last night? So what? I was working. And this thing falls apart. And guilt makes each side assume that the other one must be up to something too. That's how it works. When you have guilt in here, you assume the other one's also bad. And it goes on, and then there's emotional distance comes in there, and many a woman, has fallen into adultery because there's a husband that was no longer listening to her. That's how it happens. No longer paying attention. Many a man starts an affair because he has a wife that is withholding this vulnerability, the intimate relationship. It falls apart. And you know what? When you get through all of these and these break it down, then you're not safe anymore either. And the lowest point of a marriage is when you're all the way back to one and you're not safe anymore and you drive in the dagger. Because, Lord have mercy, there is no one that can hurt you so keenly and so deeply as the person that you have loved for years. You know that? You know why? It's because of knowledge. Two people, they know each other so thoroughly. They know the dreams and the fears of each other. They know a thousandfold more the all the right places to pinch and the sore places to poke and the bruised places to hit and the dreams to dash and the weaknesses to mock and the insecurities to leverage somehow, the failures to expose to other people, all of that. There's just, when you get down to that point, there's a thousand levers to pull to be cruel to the one you once loved. And don't think this is some faraway stuff. I've seen this firsthand, and it is the most nasty thing to watch. I have seen spouses in open fights, you know, slapping and pulling each other's hair and all of this in public. And you just want to look away. It's like, this is the ugliest point of the beautiful, most beautiful thing God created in the world. Like, this is how it can go. This is how it can go. A bitter and angry wife could cut down and emasculate her husband and stomp on his last shred of self-respect. And an angered and brutish man can humiliate the bride he married and drag her by the hair to the lowest point of her self-respect. It's all gone to where she feels like the most worthless piece of dirt that ever existed because he knows how to. And I've seen this firsthand. It is so awful. It's so far out that we think, yeah, but we're godly homes. We're Christian marriages. We would never get there. That's so far out. That's not true. It's easier to get there than you think. Just start getting a little irritated with your husband's irresponsible ways or your wife's housekeeping quirks. Just start admiring how successful or funny or something else another man is at church. Just start joking around with that sales girl at work. It's innocent, right? It's fun. Just get yourself drawn down the slopes on your phone to all the good-looking and available women that are there to medicate your hurts when you think you're distant from your wife. That's how you go. Her house is the way to hell. Going down to the chambers of death is what the Proverbs writer says. It's so, he says, I looked and I saw this man. He went down. And nothing stopped him until a dart struck through him at last. The way to the bottom is not long when selfishness is at the wheel. And so, the way up. What if you're not at the bottom, but you are somewhere below where you would like to be? How does healing begin in a marriage? With one small act of grace. One side. It's not true that it takes both to start healing. Did you know that? That's one of the hopeful reasons. If you think you're a little stressed in your marriage, well, the good news is one of you alone with one small act can get that thing turned around in the right direction. Because this is just the mystery of a marriage. And Peter talks about wives who have an unbelieving husband. What if you have a husband who doesn't love God at all? He's awful. And Peter doesn't say, well, just get shut of him. Get moving. He says, no, you may live with him because maybe he'll observe your life and he will come to the Lord. And what that tells me is that when a marriage is not what it ought to be, one of you with God's grace in your heart can start doing the little act and say, I'm sorry. I'm sorry I said that. And if you have been in habits of disagreement, that will come as a surprise. Huh. That's not what she usually says. One of you can give one little gift, do one thoughtful thing. Maybe you need to take some inventory. Well, the root cause is sin, and of course, and so it takes Jesus' blood. But we can be healed. Well, I suppose we should close here. I will say in conclusion that wisdom in marriage relationships, the wisdom blessing your marriage, it does come with time. You know, I reflected a little bit. You know, when we're first married, we think that the romance will hold us together in harmony forever. And we like to read, I mean, you can't go wrong with Song of Solomon. Thou art fair, my love, there is no spot in thee. That's beautiful. Thou hast ravished my heart with one of thine eyes. That's why Song of Solomon's there. Don't believe the people who say it's all about Christ and the church. It's not. It's about Christian marriage. And it's there. Many waters cannot quench love. And Tim Keller says, we think that we love this person on our wedding day. Actually, we just love what our idea is of this person. We only get to know this stranger over many years. And then we understand what real love is. We get to know them. And so the sparkle is real. It's immensely gratifying. The way of a man with a maid. But so that's early marriage. And then somewhere along there in the first couple of years, we get into the next stage, which is we learn that there are hot buttons. There's some sore places like, ooh, don't say that again. Oh, that didn't work. Or, ooh, don't suggest that. Vice versa, you know. That made a little, you know, why does she flare up like that? All I just said is, where'd you get the meat for these meatballs? You know, why is he giving me the silent treatment? I just ask him if he could be at home for once when it's time for supper. What did I do? And we kind of learn, you know, that as we get into marriage, okay, don't say that again. That's not a happy evening. So we learn to adjust. We avoid the ouchy places. But that's not wisdom yet. It's the beginning of wisdom. It's not wisdom yet. The third stage, and the most beautiful stage, is when we see all the ouchy spots for enough of years, and we just smile, and we offset for them. We just compensate for them. And it can be very practical things, little likes and dislikes. Yes, I know she doesn't like that. I know he doesn't like that. I know that irritates him. And it's fine. It's just fine. And, you know, it can be very practical. You think about the little thing that Jack Spratt and his wife had going, you know, where they work together. And we've always said in our marriage that, you know, when you go to those fancy meals and they have little trays with the olives and the gherkins on it and all that stuff, I like when we do that when I'm with my wife at a wedding because I don't like the olives and she doesn't like the gherkins, but we take care of the platter together. And it can be very natural things like you just your predilections, just the things you love to do for pastime, or the things that you're good at. I love to see where there's a husband who's maybe challenged in maybe his bookkeeping or getting his Sunday school lesson ready, and his wife helps him, and then he goes up front and he teaches it as though he had done this work himself. Not pridefully, but just a bigger man than he would have been without his wife. Or a wife who is courageous enough to do something on her own because her husband showed her how to do it before he left for work. And so she can go to the courthouse and take care of some legal business for the family because he helped her be brave about this. You can do it, honey. You can go for jury duty. I'll tell you what you say. Here's what you do. And she goes with his confidence, giving her strength. That's a beautiful thing in our marriage. We both like to read a lot, but my wife is so much better at remembering the plots and the names of the books we have both read, and so it's very common. In this age, I could Google this stuff, but it is immensely more gratifying for me to be somewhere in the house and my wife is doing laundry, and I'll say, what's the name of the priest in that book where the bridge breaks and everyone falls down? And she doesn't even stop folding laundry. She just says, Brother Juniper, and I say, thank you. And then she leans on me in reverse for spelling. I can spell more easily, maybe. I say that humbly, but it's true. And so she's, I'll be working, and she'll say, how many E's are in fiancé? And I say, without stopping, it depends. And so, she grew up in Texas and broke horses and stuff, and she thinks horses are wonderful. I'm scared of horses, and I don't want horses on my property to kill my children. And she, on the other hand, thinks that skid steers are inventions on Pennsylvania dairy farms that are made for driving over children. That's what they do. Lots of children die in skid steer accidents, so she's scared of those. And so we don't have either horses or skid steers on our property. But it's a beautiful thing. I know a man in my community. He's dead now, rest in peace. But he was in his 70s or 80s maybe, and he talked tirelessly to everyone he went, everywhere he went, while his wife would sit in the buggy. They were horse and buggy men. She would sit in the buggy by the hour, waiting on him to come out of the hardware store, the feed store, wherever he went. He would go in to do a 5-minute transaction and take 45 minutes without fail, and she would sit there and wait on him. And I looked at her sometimes and I thought, how does she have the grace to do that? How? I can about imagine some of you having some thoughts on that. That when he comes out, we're going to have a discussion. And she did it, as far as I could tell, quietly for years. I never heard her cut him down as the old windbag or whatever you want to call him. Why don't you stop talking? She just quietly waited on him. That's the grace of God and the beautiful thing of a marriage, but It's something for us to remember, too. My family waits in the van a lot, too, but that's because it takes so long to listen to some people. But a good marriage over the years becomes golden and unshakable. It's a beautiful thing. And I don't know if you dislike this, maybe, but I'll say it. I would not exchange my marriage today and what I experience for the first year of my marriage for anything. Is anybody with me who's been married a number of years? Okay. And that doesn't mean that it wasn't beautiful and exciting back then. It just means that it got a lot better. And that, my friends, could have been the other way around. I could have been at the bottom where my first year of marriage was as good as it ever was. I had a man tell me recently that the best years, the only good years of his marriage was the first 6 weeks, and it's been awful ever since. So, it can be a beautiful thing. Men, if you can keep seeing your bride as the lily of the valley, even though the decades take their toll, if you can see your groom as that prince that came out of the wilderness, like Song of Solomon talks about, and he's altogether lovely, even though things change, and say, like the writer there says, this is my beloved, this is my friend, then you will have shown your children how glorious a covenant marriage is. And you will enable your children to have those kinds of marriages. It's the most powerful thing you can do in a fallen world. Let's pray.